wonderful to be back in this church after a long absence. I've spoken here several times in recent, not in recent years, but over the years. Going back to the time of Don Rowland. I'm going to skip my reading for this morning. I see that the time is moving on, and my sermon is about 3 hours long, so I thought I'd spare you. Before I begin, though, I just want to acknowledge that I keep an eye on all the congregations in our district. And one of the things that's really been very important to hear about this particular congregation is that I know you haven't had an offering for years and years and years, but then suddenly to start one and to give it all away is a wonderful thing, and you should be very, very happy for yourselves for doing that. Congratulations. My mother-in-law is being taken home sometime this week to spend the last few days of her life. And so this sermon is somewhat of a reflection of that loss in my life and our life. She's 92, and I've known her since 1947. And she's an extraordinary person, and I love her very dearly. So even though I prepared this sermon before that, it has a lot of personal meaning in regard to her. And it is a personal sermon I want to share with you. For a few minutes, I'd like to share with you some very personal words about my faith. It's a simple faith. It's not cluttered and hampered by theological abstractions. I probably couldn't defend it very well if I were confronted by my seminary professors. Most of them are dead anyway. Most of them were dead then. Faith for me was born in experience, not learned from school books. Its roots aren't in the seminary, but rather in the heart and mind of my living. These days are troubling times. The events of our nation and our world grip us with a wrenching drama of suffering and pain, sorrow and confusion, doubt and fear. Awful things are happening, and most times there's nothing we can do to stop them from happening. We can only stand by and watch and experience our common loss, strengthened by our communities, I hope, by our rituals of culture, and by a history, a human and faithful history that is full of recovery. But the closer that tragedy and loss come to us, how we recover has much more to do with our own inner resources. When we lose a loved member of our family, the challenge is all the greater. I will tell you, when I first heard the grim news on Tuesday morning, September 11, 2001, at my temporary home on Long Island, 20 miles east of New York City, that we had been attacked in the city and Washington, that news had far less of an impact on me and my wife than the fresh wounds of 4 days earlier when I learned that my youngest son had been diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. Faith in my nation to survive September 11th was easy to find, but faith in me to survive my son's dying was quite another matter. Faith. Oh God, every day we are confronted with the grim reality of reality, in disease, in dying, in death, in loss of all kinds, in fear, in loneliness. It is all around us. Sometimes the day may feel like we're clinging to the side of a lifeboat in a raging sea, and we're about to lose our grip. And sometimes it feels like no feeling at all, like a dead emptiness. And yet, most of us choose as a way out or through the possibilities that seem to be in the nature to be offered by life for our sustenance. There is something in the nature of the universe, I believe, that can save us, not by what it does, but by what we do with it. I'm reminded of some words by my colleague, Earl Holt, minister of King's Chapel in Boston, with a liturgy far different than here in Nashville. Earl wrote, "Nonetheless, a potent religion must address the darkness, inner and outer. That darkness is real. Moments of grace do come, but not easily or often. And it's most often those who acknowledge the darkness who recognize the grace." After our son called on that dark Friday afternoon with his diagnosis, I was overcome with intense grief, flailing in the negative fears of all the worst things that could happen to him, from paralysis to death. I went to bed that night and said to my wife, the words I didn't have to say, "I don't want to watch my son die." It was a common response to the question that every alternate life confrontation begs. What will sustain me now when my life is falling apart? I'm alone and I'm scared in an immense impersonal universe, and I'm asking who or what will hold me. It is most often those who acknowledge the darkness who recognize the grace. I want to tell you that almost in that very moment, I also had a welcome emerging sense of well-being, and I knew from where it was coming. I had experienced it before, vicariously, through the faithful experience of many of my parishioners over 37 years of ministry, as I accompanied them through their dying, witnessing their suffering and their spiritual redemption. And I had experienced it in my own struggles through life's ultimate battles, where I had discovered my real faith under fire. I remember with particular intensity the gruesome experience of my next older brother's close encounter with death, where I was pushed to the edge of meaning, where my faith was challenged and tested in a way no questioning theology professor could ever hope to reach. I had to face the loss of someone close to me in ways I have difficulty articulating. Those of you who have siblings and have gone through trauma with them, perhaps losing them, know the feelings. As it turned out, confronting my brother's dying was one of the most important spiritual moments of my life. I learned more theology from that challenge than 4 years in seminary. It became the defining affirmation of my faith. I could rationalize and describe my faith, but I'd never really lived that faith at life's core. It was a terrifying moment of darkness and fear when I called upon all that I knew in the universe to hold me when I most needed holding, when I was alone and afraid. And then, the more stark and miserable thought of losing my youngest child tried my faith once again, but like never before, and still reaffirmed it. One thing I've learned is that it simply doesn't work to try to run from these terrible possibilities. They ought to be confronted. They need to be worked through for our own good mental and spiritual health. It is most often those who acknowledge the darkness who recognize grace. Now, I don't stand here telling you that I believe that whatever happens is God's will. Religion doesn't work that way for me. But it's not enough for me to say, on the other hand, that that's life, that's fate. I don't believe I'm simply a mass of chemicals flung together at random. I do believe that my consciousness grows out of a deeper or greater consciousness that I can glimpse only through symbols or rarely through sublime experiences. But I found only one reliable answer to these questions. It may not be enough for you, but I offer it anyway. I will say that I don't think it was God that reassured me during my brother's close visit with death. As I watch my son's slow but steady decline from his illness, I don't believe it's God who still promises me, but I do resonate with the old universalist phrase to rest assured. Something was and is surely at work within me, some power or force or understanding or realization or memory of prior experience. Something was and is telling me that everything is going to be all right. It doesn't say that my brother would live or that I'll be spared watching my son suffer for the rest of his or my life, or even that I would or will survive. Either way, it's much more than that. This inner urging voice reaffirms, it asserts that life is good and worthwhile. For want of a better phrase, it is hope at the heart of things. Rest assured. This hope is at the core of my faith, partly because so many years of ministry have taught me this through a remarkable witnessing of faithful people and their incredible, shining example through times of horrific personal struggle. It's a faith based in part from living 61 years, continually working through my own pain and trouble and doubt. And yet, I don't understand everything that happens. I don't know why bad things happen to good people, or why good things happen to bad people. But I do say that joy is available to all of us, sooner or later, one way or another. Our faith, or our lack of faith, is tested regularly. I think perhaps that my sufferings are trivial compared to many others I know, that my faith may not have been sufficiently tested yet. I could be mistaken in what I believe and trust. I haven't been gravely ill. I'm in reasonably good health and always have been. The manic depression that has twisted and tortured many of my mother's side of my family, including an aunt who would sit in a dark room without speaking for weeks on end, and a cousin who would jump to her death. None of this has visited me in any significant way. My home hasn't burned down. I haven't been robbed of my family treasures. I've never been in jail, justly or otherwise. I have not lost a child. But I know others who have had all of those tragedies visit them, and in spite of their suffering, they have still found at the core of their lives the same basic optimism or hope that I found. They have testified that we can find God or spirit or the good, the strength that sustains and holds us up when we're alone in a frightening universe. They have found it in the slightest of things, sometimes in the least likely places, or conversely, they found it in the most obvious places. Perhaps you knew the late Dean Starr, who held my position as DE for the New Hampshire-Vermont District several years ago. I remember with gratitude a story that Dean often told about his faith. He He'd been in Oregon for the memorial service for his son, who had died of AIDS. He had said that after the service, he felt abandoned, bereft, anguished, and alone, and lonely. He had lost his son. He had been divorced a few years earlier. He was desperately lonely, in awful pain. He could not pray, which was natural to him. He found no comfort, no solace in church, where he normally would go. But then he decided to go on an evening cruise. The boat went out into the Pacific Ocean off the west coast. The day was drawing to its end. And then a moment of serenity came over Dean. He said, "I couldn't find peace in church or in prayer. I looked into the sunset and I found peace there." Something as natural and common as a sunset. And sometimes we can be saved by something as simple as a song. In the summer of 1994, at the General Assembly of the Unitarian Universalist Association, a Congregationalist minister, text samples, led 400 Unitarian Universalist ministers in a day of storytelling, telling stories and learning how to tell stories. Reverend Mr. Samples told one especially powerful story about the hymn "In the Garden," which I'm sure will forever change my perception of this old tune, which has rarely found favor with Unitarian Universalists. Perhaps you know it. It's a gospel hymn from the early evangelical movement in the United States. Now, I know for some of you this may be disturbing to hear, either because it's from a faith you have rejected or you philosophically abhor. But please hear me out. Wait for its context, and maybe you'll have a deeper appreciation for how something so alien to me and to you can be of such powerful meaning to another person, as Tex Samples learned for himself. So, here you go. If you know the hymn, please sing a couple of verses along with me and see if you can appreciate its comforting lilt for others. And then wait for the context. "I come to the garden alone, while the dew is still on the roses, and the voice I hear falling on my ear, the Son of God discloses, and he walks with me, and he talks with me, and he tells me as ever known. You did very, very well. Michaels said that he used to hate that hymn. He said it seemed so sentimental, so self-indulgent, so sticky. Such bad music, you know? And one day, I was speaking to a religious gathering, and I sang the hymn in a high, forced falsetto. After my talk, continued Mr. Samples, when people came up to speak with me, I noticed one woman was waiting some distance from the others. Only after everyone else had left did she come up. She said, "You know that hymn you sang?" Mr. Samples said, "Yes." She said, "I want to tell you something about that hymn. From the time I was about 10 years old until I was about 14, my father raped me almost every day of my life. After he was finished, I'd put my clothes on and I'd go out into the backyard and I'd walk slowly about the yard and I'd sing that hymn. It was the only thing that kept me sane. The only thing that kept me from killing myself. Because when I sang that hymn, I knew I was somebody. I hope you remember that the next time you sing it, Mr. Sanders." The hymn was all she had. But it was enough. In recounting this story, my friend and colleague Carl Scovel said, in his own religious language, that God had used this woman, whom none of us will ever know, to point to the goodness at the heart of life and to remind us that nothing in heaven or earth, not death, not life, nor powers, nor principalities, not even a drunken father who raped his daughter, can separate us from the love of God, the good intent at the heart of reality. In a changing world, that good intent is permanent, changeless, lovely, and sure. And I'm reminded of some words Edward Frost, minister of the Unitarian Universalist Congregation of Atlanta, wrote in a meditation for his church after the horrible bombing of a federal building in Oklahoma City a few years ago that killed nearly 200 innocent people. Many people found comfort recalling those words in the deep anguish following the World Trade Center tragedy 2.5 years ago. Edward was right on the mark, I think, reminding his congregation of the good intent of the universe, as Carl Scovel calls it. He was speaking about the peace that's in the glorious sunset, as Dean Starr would claim it. He was reaffirming a fundamental hope at the heart of things, as I would put it. "For every insane bomber," wrote Edward Frost, "there are tens of millions of people who will crawl into the smoking ruins toward the voice of a crying child, who will sit and cry for the suffering of people they never knew, and who will, in the face of such evil, remind us over and over again of what is good." I call it hope at the heart of things. The old universalist said, "Rest assured." I believe, as the humanist Dag Hammarskjöld did, that God does not die on the day when we cease to believe in a personal deity, but we die on the day when our lives cease to be illuminated by the steady radiance, renewed daily, of a wonder, the source of which is beyond all reason. Rest